I mentioned it's kind of interesting because you and I figured out we're born a month and 17 days apart.
Right.
Did you ever think you'd still be performing music at the tender age of blank?
I am not totally surprised. What I was doing, like when I was in my 20s, well, I mean the foundation of the Go-Betweens, which is how I got started playing music, was never built really on a rock and roll, let's live quick and let's die quick and let's and this whole sort of rock and roll ethos that we had to start of everything, you know, just going 100 mile an hour and you sort of collapse when you're 30 was not the way that we really approached it. I guess the fact that we actually, I think, kept making music by about the age of 25, I think that's a cutoff point to an extent. If you're still doing it then and you're making records and you're enjoying it and things are moving a little bit for you, then I think you'll keep going. I almost could have seen us doing our first two singles back in 1978 and 79, and then Grant McLennan and I, who started the band, getting into something else. You know, like we had aspirations to be filmmakers or something like that. So there was always a chance that it was going to take a turn there. But give it a couple more years till we were 25, and being here at my age now is really not a total surprise.
And you and Grant, if I remember the story, both didn't start out to be musicians. Now, you were originally studying drama.
Yeah.
So can you take a little bit of the story from there?
I was at Queensland University and Grant McLennan was at Queensland University. We were both doing a drama course and I was sort of playing in a band with a friend from school and I started to write songs. And he was not a musician but he, at the age of 19, he'd finished university. He was extremely bright and doing far better than I was. And he sort of had some spare time. I think he wanted to go into film and he was almost too young to go to film school. And I just started to write my first good songs, I guess. And after going through a number of musicians in the band that I was in, where I could see that musicians mightn't be on my wavelength, I needed someone who was basically a friend that I could teach and so that we could build the band from there. And so the Go-Betweens started like that, like two friends where one teaches the other friend who doesn't play music to play a musical instrument, which in Grant's case was the bass.
And it's not one of my questions, but it occurred to me as you were talking about this, and we were talking about this when we were doing the session, that's fascinating to me is, so the Go-Betweens in Australia had a modicum of success. Mm. They've had a modicum of success in the UK. Mm. But what's always intriguing to me, and the last time that I saw the Go-Betweens, friend turned to me and said, "Where did all these people come from?"
Right.
And so it's always interesting to me how bands who are perceived, say, in the United States as not being a super group or being huge, but every time you come here, there's a lot of people who show up. Mm. So, and this was way before this internet YouTube situation. So what do you think, when you think about success of a band and you think about the Go-Betweens, tell me what your feeling on all of that is.
The first impulse is to me the fact that the Go-Betweens from the beginnings that I just described to you from Brisbane, that we went on to make like 9 albums and that we're known in America and that we're known in Europe is to me a sign of some sort of success, not in financially, but in terms of things accomplished. But I think what also has to be understood is that we came from a town where no one made albums. No one. There's some rock history there, but little in the way of what's recorded. It's not like being a San Franciscan band where you've obviously got this huge weight of history where there's people walking the streets that have made albums. There's people who go to the bakery and they were in some sort of late 60s band and they can, you know, we're selling bagels and we've also made 3 albums in, you know, late 60s. In Brisbane, you didn't meet people that had musical careers or had done. So the fact that we came from there and achieve this was something. And once we were making records, the records travel, and I think people could sense something special, or the lyrics or the sound affected people. So we always had an audience that was quite fevered, and so where we went, there was people there, not millions, but always people who are interested in what we're doing.
Now, in addition to the Go-Betweens, The Evangelist really is your fifth, am I correct, solo album? Did I count right?
Yes, you have, yes.
And in the second that you recorded in the UK, and the last time that you did a solo album was 11 years ago, which you recorded with the amazing Edwin Collins.
Yes.
Who my listeners, and hopefully anybody listening to this, is if they're not aware, well, then they don't get to be in this conversation with you and I. And I understand this time when you once again worked with Mark Wallace, you talked quite a bit about how the record would sound.
Yes. This was a very important thing to me because it was the first record that I made after Grant McLean, who we've been talking about, passed away in 2006. And so this solo career, making my fifth solo album, was something that was totally unforeseen for me. I didn't think really that I was going to make another solo album. I had nothing planned in this at all. And so Grant passed away, and suddenly I was thrown out on the street, and the Go-Betweens were over. And so I approached this record. It was very special circumstances, and I had when I was Mark had made two Go-Betweens albums, the last Go-Betweens album, an album called 16 Lovers Lane, that came out in the late 80s, and working with him, I had a definite idea how I wanted this record to sound, which was quite a lot sparser than he's normally used to working with. I wanted to work with more natural instruments, which he is used to working, but not too many treatments on it. I didn't want a dense record. Sometimes when you're making records, you drift into a sound and it all works out fine. Other times you have very, very particular ideas come to you. Not every record, but this is one that I had. And I wanted it performance-based. I wanted nylon-string guitars, acoustic guitars, piano, voices. There's less drums on this than anything I've ever done, including the Go-Betweens. So it's a very sort of a personal... There was a story to tell, and I wanted the voice right on top telling the story.
And speaking of that story, and I know you've talked about this quite a bit, but I think it's very important to talk about, three of the songs were co-written with Grant, last being Demon Days, and these were the result, and I know you've told the tale multiple times, but I'd love you to tell me it again, at least I've read it multiple times,
yes,
about how you went about going through the notebook and the diary, and how, because when I read it last night, I kind of, you know, having met Grant, I kind of took a deep breath, and I thought, there's Grant watching and saying, this is exactly why I kept this.
Yeah. That's a good point. We're working on what was going to be the 10th Go-Betweens album, and Grant always wrote more songs than I did, and we'd sort of practiced. We had about 8 songs that we could play straight up. 6 were his, 2 were mine, and we were working to an album that was going to be the following year, 2007, we're going to record it. And we'd practiced probably about 6 or 7 times, and then he passed away. He died of a heart attack at the age of 48, and so there was like one cassette recording of like one song. So these songs were just in my head, you know, and in my fingers. And these songs were very precious to me because he was in a really good patch of songwriting, and he was totally on fire. And so there was these songs that if I didn't record them, I thought would disappear. So I was obviously thinking of making another record because I'd written some songs myself, and I took 3 of his songs, which I thought was a good number. I knew the album was going to be 10, like just like I knew what the sound was going to be like. I knew the structure of the album was going to be 10, and I thought 3 of his was good. And I worked on... I knew that he didn't have many lyrics. He tended to write lyrics later, in the latter part of his career. And so I... through his family, I got his lyric book, and went through and could see what lyrics he wrote for these three songs, which was not many, and then I finished the lyrics to these songs that he'd started. He all the structures were there, all the melodies were there, which I remembered, all the chord sequences I remembered, but I just finished off these songs and they became part of the Evangelist album.
It Ain't Easy was the last to be written, and that truly, I think that it's an ironic title because it was so not an easy song to write.
Mm. It was a very difficult one, and also, you know, it obviously changes, and I do this purposefully. That's Grant's chorus. He had the chorus to these three songs, so he has a chorus of It Ain't Easy. Where he was going with that, I have no idea. But that song is like a portrait of Grant. And so the It Ain't Easy has this other meaning that fits my lyric and would have fitted his lyric. And it's a portrait of him. I wrote many, many paragraphs and verses for that. And I settle on the ones that I got. But I wanted to put him in a pop song was important for me because Grant was a great lover of pop, was his forte. He loved it. And so to honour him and I guess give a portrait of him, I thought, pop song, yeah. Did She Overtake You was probably one of the first songs that I wrote for the album. This is a song that one of the two that I was saying that Grant and I were playing. And I wrote this quite early. And it's a song about a couple. And who I sort of knew. It's quite normally I don't write too much about other people's lives because I don't want to get into too much trouble. But this is like a couple that set out on a career, and the woman goes on in that career and becomes well known, and the person that she started with sort of falls away, and it's a little bit of his surprise how well she's done in her career, and so it's about a couple and one person, the woman in the relationship, going on to great success. Hello, this is Robert Forster, and this song is called Did She Overtake You? 1, 2, 3, 4. Wait for her friend. Dennis is a song about the last hour of the day. It was written at the beach where I live, and where I holiday is in Brisbane, and there's beaches all around. And so I have beaches are in all of our childhoods, and it's just about that hour at the end of the day when people are walking along the beach, and it's sort of, you know, that pale purple light, and the water's sort of got that silver color. It's a friendly time. The night's not there, but it's coming. The day's gone, and a lot of people do sort of beach walks. It's almost too hot to do too much beach walking during summer, and so people tend to walk early in the morning or in the evening. And it's about that time. And I was, while I was writing the song, the lyric for it, I was living in this old beach house with my family, which we were renting. And the house is actually called Pandanus, which is like a tree that grows there. It's a Pandanus tree. Probably particular to Australia, I don't know, or to Queensland. And sort of tropical, subtropical. And so Pandanus it was an old-fashioned beach house, and this sort of old-fashioned name in a way, and there's pandanus trees actually in the backyard of the, which is probably why they called it that. And so I named the song, didn't have a strong bang, that's the chorus thing to it, and so I just called it after the house that we were staying in, and the house was called Pandanus. Oh, hang on, I've got to introduce it. Hello, this is Robert Forster, and this song that we're going to play now is called Pandanus.
Off the moon was dying. There
That's free-flowing rock and roll. Hello, this is Robert Forster, and the next song we're going to do is called Surfing Magazines. 1, 2, 3, 4... We used to get our kicks reading surfing magazines. Some good looking people wearing Lee Cooper jeans. They're breaking on the headland, they're breaking on the shore. And when you're living in Hawaii, they're breaking at your door.
So
is Robert Forster, and we're doing Head Full of Steam. Yeah, yeah. Hello, Robert Forster with Here Comes the City. Thank you.
Metallica Pusher, here comes the city, pushing you away from me, pushing you away from me. Central, here comes the city. Why do people who read Dostoevsky look like Dostoevsky? Crowded train, a silent night. The country's black and the cities are bright. On this flight through the night.
So how do you choose your subjects, as a being that you are a musician and you're writing about music?
That's a good question. It's whatever catches my fancy in the month. I have total freedom, which is a great thing. It's not like I have to have a running commentary on what's happening in pop, you know, like a weekly columnist for a newspaper, say, where I have to, you know, make a comment on the latest Madonna record or the latest, you know, whatever. I don't have to keep a running thing like that going. Anything. I mean, the latest one I've just done is the new Glen Campbell album, which I've just actually proofread today, and which I find a really good record. I like a lot of people, I guess. I love what he did in the late 60s, and I find this a very good record. And it's just, I don't know, I get it off the internet, I might hear about it, some things just, I don't know, they just fall out. Sometimes people send me records. It just, like the Vampire Weekend I was reviewing, it came out, I knew it was like a hot record, but I didn't pick it up early in the year, and then I was writing this piece on this other Australian band who was sort of like early 20s and had this sort of collegiate image. And I thought, maybe I'll bring this Vampire Weekend record, which I hadn't heard, and suddenly so I get that and I really like that. And the Australian band I didn't, you know, like paled in comparison. But things just sort of come from. But the main thing is I follow things that I know. You know, that like Glen Campbell I know. Like the next thing that I'm probably interested in is the new Bob Dylan Telltale Signs, which is coming out. I know Dylan, and so I can immediately, I've got the first paragraph, you know, like I, but it's still, I don't want to be scared about not trying new things. So, but when I try something new, I almost let the reader know I'm trying something new. And so it's not me trying to bluff my way through as a big authority. And so it's just working out a voice and working out what interests me, you know.
What's your first musical memory?
Oh, that's... listening to radio when I was like 3 or 4, and there's a whole lot of songs that I only worked out later what I was listening to. It was like, I don't come from a musical family, And so it was a radio on in the morning where for my father to go to work to. And it must have shown that these songs went into me, because there's no musical thing, but I can remember, you know, like songs like Nat King Cole, those Lazy, Crazy, Hazy Days of Summer, Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You. It's all just pre-Beatles. I now look at this and I can see it's 1960 to 1962. You know, like, and even though I can remember the Beatles hitting when I was six. But these songs, Eddie Hodges, I'm Going to Knock on Your Door, Andy Williams, Red Roses for a Blue Lady, you know, these, Moon River, you know, these sort of songs, and I must have been only four or five, and I would have heard the money probably three or four times, although this radio station was almost like a news thing as well, so they kept playing the same songs. And these are the first songs. It's quite bizarre. I'd love to do, like, there'd have to be a Creedence song there. There's actually a, I throw in one reference to this actually, which is in at the end of Here Comes the City. I throw it on the record, and I think when I sang it today, is the Roland, which is from Creedence Rolling on the River, which is a little minor thing that means a lot to me. But, you know, for me to throw in a Roland, you know, in my late 40s into a song was a big thing. Yesterday, well, I don't know if it'd fit. I heard Tommy James dragging the line yesterday. I was actually in City Lights Bookshop, which is one place I always go when I come here. And I was downstairs, if people know City Lights, and I was downstairs, and there was a guy in the next room. There was a door open, and there was someone in the computer I could hear. And I was down there, and Dragon the Line came in by Tommy James, and I just like, oh God, I love that song. I haven't heard it for such a long time. He then the next song was Rock On by David Essex, another real favourite of mine. The third one was Terry Jackson's Season in the Sun, and I walked in and I put my head around the door, and I said, you listen to a radio station, like what is this, you know? And he said it's a private tape, a cassette, he said, that I made of my favourites. And he said, I gave it to my ex-girlfriend. I gave her the tape and she gave it back to me because she said it was too sad. And I was just like, I just said to him, those last three songs are like fantastic. And I could see a link, you know, like they followed each other.